Hello, homies. So those of you that have been listening to this podcast for a while or are clients of mine or who know me know that I am passionate about my ongoing continuing professional development. Now, about a year ago, I did this great course on repertorization through the website Naturopathic CE, and the lecturer was Dr. Matt Zorn. So I was completely blown away by this course. It was so helpful. So when I started this podcast, I knew I had to get him on the show. Now, I'm always trying to educate the general public on the types of questions and the types of information that is really helpful for us in the consultation process so that we can help you to help us so you can achieve the best results at the end of the day. And who better to get on than Dr. Matt Zorn to get into the nitty-gritty of the bits of information that's going to be really helpful for us in the homeopathic process. So enjoy this episode, and I hope that when you next go to see your homeopath, it will make you think of some bits of information that you might be able to give them that maybe you haven't previously, and who knows, that might be the missing piece to the puzzle. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Homeopathy Hangout podcast, where we discuss all things homeopathy from around the world. And now, your host, Eugenie Kruger.
Hello, homies, and thank you for joining us today as we get to hang out with Dr. Matthew Zorn. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm super excited to have you on because I have done a few of your courses, and I might have mentioned to you that you know you're doing a great course when 1 minute and 40 seconds into the course, you learn something that after 10 years of practice, you never knew. So I just think you're an absolute legend and king of the homeopathic repertory, along with Luke Norland. I just put you two up there on pedestals when it comes to repertorization, which is such a powerful tool that us as homeopaths have. But I think repertorization will be a whole other podcast in itself. So I will leave that one for another day. But maybe we can start off, Matthew, with you telling us how you discovered homeopathy.
Sure. Well, the way I discovered homeopathy was I was in the program that I was in back in 98 to 2002. And I had plantar warts that I hadn't been able to get rid of in 7 years. My brother also had plantar warts. And so I went to a homeopath that had just graduated. She took a look at them. She gave me a little blue tube. It cost me $5. She said, take 3 pellets per day. And by day 4, they were gone. And it just completely blew me away because my brother had taken a different route, the allopathic route. He went to a podiatrist. It cost $800 out of pocket. They used a laser. They were burning the warts out of his feet with the laser. He was changing bloody gauze. He was in pain. So I said, wow, $5, painless, gone in 4 days, whereas he had them, couldn't get rid of them. And he just went through all this pain and it cost so much money. So that really kind of opened my eyes to what homeopathy is. And then the other thing is I've always been kind of a maverick. I've always kind of thought outside the box. I've always challenged orthodoxy. So when I started reading up on homeopathy, it just kind of resonated with me. So that was my initial experience with it.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. And what made you decide to become a homeopathic practitioner and to practice it yourself?
Well, in the program I was going through, they offered naturopathic medicine, homeopathy, and Chinese medicine. And I figured I wanted to do something that was energetically based because I didn't want to, you know, if you're a practitioner and you're practicing allopathically, you're essentially going to war every day. You're going to battle a disease, you know, battle a syndrome. To me, going to war and health and peace, they're opposites. You can't be at peace and at war at the same time. So, you know, if you've got an autoimmune disease, you can say that that autoimmune disease is an entity of in and of itself and that you have to go to war against it, but then you'll never be at peace. You'll never truly find health. So I found that the two were Chinese medicine and homeopathy that were energetically based, where the disease wasn't something to be fought, but it was the result of an imbalance. And then if you really understood the person and you really understood the rules that govern health and disease, that you could rectify the disease or the imbalance in the person without actually going to war. And so that's why I chose homeopathy. Because I knew I couldn't master both of them because they're both you know, sealed in and of themselves. So I figured, let me go with homeopathy.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say is true health? Or what is your definition of health?
Health, well, I'm going to borrow from James Tyler Kent in his book, The Philosophy of Homeopathy. or Kent's lectures on philosophy of homeopathy, he talks about health as being freedom. And he says that health is freedom physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. I'm paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. But essentially, there's four different realms or layers. And the individual needs to feel a sense of freedom, freedom from the signs and symptoms of disease or on those four different levels. So that's a general definition of what health is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Maybe you can tell us a little bit, because this podcast is obviously aimed at the general public. And we had a quick little chat beforehand, and I was telling you, like, some of my frustration is when we're getting somebody who is completely new to homeopathy, who comes and sees us for a consultation, they really have no idea what to expect, because homeopathy is such a completely different paradigm to mainstream medicine, which is usually where most people come from. So part of my mission is to try and help the general public to understand what sort of things we as homeopaths need to know to be able to help them the most. Now, I actually have now in my terms of service, clients have to complete my free online course before they come for treatment to see me, just so that they have the basics of it, because it's no use spending half your consult trying to explain to them what homeopathy is and what they need to know when you could be spending their time really getting to help them. So I'm wondering, Matt, do you mind doing a deep dive for us into what exactly a client needs to know before they come to see us, of what sort of information is really helpful for us to help them the most?
Okay. So in essence, what people should know when they choose to go see a homeopath is that, well, number one, they should just be open. If you have any preconceived notions, those might actually get in the way. Hmm. So it's interesting because Kent said in his book on the Lesser Writings, he was talking about, I think the title of it was The Making of a Man or something like that. And he talked about how the homeopath gives a remedy. The remedy cures the patient. The patient comes back and tells the homeopath that they're better. And he said, then the homeopath sheds a tear and thanks God, right? And so what that means is that it's the homeopath isn't really responsible for the healing of the patient, that the homeopath is part of this much bigger circle. And the patient's also part of that circle. Like, when you're not well, you have to try to realize. It's hard sometimes. I understand when people are depressed or, you know, they're riddled with anger or depression, but you are absolutely connected to everything in this universe. You know, you are a part and parcel of it. And one of the reasons that we suffer is because we don't realize how connected we are to the whole. That, you know, we are an integral part of it. You know, everything, the universe, all of the potential of the universe is within us. Mm-hmm. So it would be helpful for the patient to understand when they go to see a homeopath, just to stay open. You know, there's a level of surrender. As practitioners, there's a level of surrender that we have to reach or strive towards, because we're not the doers. We apply ourselves to every patient the same, and some people get better and some people don't, right? So what's the difference between the two? The difference is they're just not ready to heal yet. It's not in our hands as practitioners. We do the best we can. We apply ourselves. We use our training, we use everything that we've been exposed to, but it's really up to a higher power when somebody is gonna heal. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a philosophical point to your question. Practically, they should just realize that when they go to see a homeopath, I ask questions that they may not even think has anything to do with their headache or that has nothing to do with, you know, their PMS or whatever. And just be open to the process. I think that would be the most meaningful thing, is when you go into something with intention and you're open to any possibility. And then that's when the magic happens. So that's what I would say to that.
Absolutely. Now, what types of questions would you ask a client in the clinic? Like, what sort of things are helpful for you to know? And I guess it depends on the pace that's coming in. We have jargon that we use, like modalities and concomitants and all that sort of things. But how would you translate that into layman's terms as to how these things are helpful for us?
Sure, sure. So you want to start, I like to start with open-ended questions, right? And the open-ended question is something that's not directed. It's just, you know, something as simple as, so how can I help you today? Or so what, you know, what's your chief complaint today? And I have a template that I follow, whether it's an acute or a chronic condition, because one of the things that I personally try to avoid is too much human story. human story is something that you can't really prescribe on because it's too general for the human experience. And so what I like to do is I like to understand, like get an overview of what is the chief complaint or chief complaints. So if somebody says, as an example, well, I get chronic headaches, I've got asthma, and I get menstrual symptoms or PMS, right? So, and I'll say, okay, is there anything else besides that? And if you're any of those three things, I say, no, there's nothing else. Then I want to go into each one of those into in depth as far as homeopathy goes. And then, of course, we do a review of systems, skin, musculoskeletal, genitourinary. And then, of course, we get into sleep and then sleep positions. And then we look at things, well, what are they sensitive to? So we look at diet, and then we look at sensitivity to weather and things like that. So we do cover everything. But when I take a case, I want to make sure that I stick to the chief complaints, the things that the individual, that person's consciousness, it's bothering their awareness. So they're so aware of it, they're coming to see you for help. And the remedy really needs to address the chief complaint, the suffering of the chief complaint. Because if it doesn't, and this is something that I went through when I was going through training where, you know, we're all brand new students. We are being overseen by a licensed professional. We give a remedy and they come back and their chief complaint isn't any better. But their dreams have changed a bit. And then we go into our conference room and we say, well, is the remedy working? And then somebody says, well, I think it's working because their sleep is a little bit better, but the chief complaint hasn't changed and it's been 3 or 4 weeks. So I like to make sure that in follow-ups that we're looking at the chief complaint in percentages. Are the headaches reducing in frequency, in duration, and intensity? Or, you know, what you could apply that to headaches, you could apply that to asthma attacks, you could apply that to IBS symptoms. So I got off a little bit on topic. People should just be aware when they go to a homeopath to stay open to any possibility, be open to the process, and then be prepared to be asked strange or odd questions. That's just how we are. That's how we operate as homeopaths. So do you want to get into modalities and components now?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do that.
Okay. So some of the things that we look for are the uniqueness. What makes this person in front of me unique compared to the other 10 people that also come in with, as example, with headaches, right? Headaches are very, very common. So we're, as homeopaths, we're striving to find what makes you unique, right? Because not everybody that has a headache experiences the headache in the same way. For some people, they get headaches when they strain their eyes too long, right? So we can go into the repertoire and look at their head pain from exertion of the eyes. It'll give us about 50 remedies. So that'll kind of get us into the ballpark. That's really what we're doing. When we're asking questions, we're trying to discern and sift out what is unique to you, which is going to indicate the remedy, and what's unique to the state that you're in that is causing the headaches that you're experiencing. And then what do we not really pay attention to because it's too general? I've found with headaches, typically most people get headaches. They're across the forehead or in the temples, maybe in the parietal area. I'd say 60 to 70%. So location doesn't really help all that much. So there's a good book. It's a short book that I recommend to all students of homeopathy. It's Eugene Nash's How to Take the Case and Find the Similimum. You can find it online for free. It's a very small book. I think it's about 45 to 48 pages. And in it, Dr. Nash lays out how to take the case. And it's a good, strong foundational template that if you apply it to acutes and chronic cases, it gives you a strong foothold, a good foundation to start building your understanding of homeopathy. And in it, he goes over things like what is an exciting cause? Right. So an exciting cause is something that triggers symptoms, or it puts the person into the state that they're now in that perpetuates chronic headaches or it perpetuates PMS. An exciting cause could be anything from divorce in childhood. It could be from a loss of money in a business failure, a business venture where the business, you know, goes bankrupt and the person is never well since that point. So it's really a divergence in the person's life. What's not an exciting cause is if somebody, as an example, has a sibling or a family member pass away and they go through their grieving process, but then they come back to their general state. It didn't really shift where their vital force is, right? Because we can have stresses that we go through in life that push us off kilter. We go through a process of where we process the stress. It doesn't matter what it is. And we, if our vitality is strong, we find our way back to our center point. That doesn't need treatment. What needs treatment is when the exciting cause, as an example, a death of a loved one, pushes the person into a state where they're never able to recover back to that center point. But now they're in a, the exciting cause was so intense that it pushed their vitality or their spiritual energy off the course to a point where they can't recover. That would require homeopathic treatment. So an exciting cause can be that. It can be a change in weather. It could be fright. Yeah.
Fright. Shock. It could be car accident.
Yeah. Yep. Car accidents. It could be anger. It could be, something. There's a rubric, anxiety after a fright, under the mind chapter. And there's about 12, 15, I think there's two different rubrics that represent that. Mm-hmm. Or fear after a fright. Mm-hmm. Opium's the main one, but Nat Mir's in there, Ignatius in there. So definitely things like that could be exciting causes.
There's an exciting cause I see in my clinic quite often because I have a lot of little children, and that's the birth of a sibling. And you can have a child that's, one sort of temperament, and a sibling is born, and that just, they never quite recover after that. It's just this new layer that's added there, and you can see that child's just really struggling. So even something like that could be an exciting cause as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we don't want to limit what an exciting cause is. In general, the definition is something that the person has a sensitivity to. So when they experience it, it pushes their vitality in a way where they cannot recover. So that can be pretty much almost anything depending on a person's sensitivity. The other thing that we look for, and these are really helpful, are modalities. And modalities are things that make symptoms better or make symptoms worse, right? So we have patients that say, anytime the weather changes, I get a headache. So the change in weather could be a modality, or they can't go out in sunny weather because it causes a headache, or consuming milk. Milk, that's an aggravating factor. That's something that would make their stomach pain worse, or it causes diarrhea. So anything that makes symptoms better or worse, or brings on symptoms from the state that they're in, would be a modality. The ones we ignore are medications, right? Somebody says, I get PMS symptoms, I take some medication and it relieves my symptoms. That for a homeopath, that's completely useless as far as information that we're trying to gather, because the medication isn't in the realm of the natural world. It's not, we're looking for things in the person's environment. Modalities could be things like posture, right? When I get a headache, I need to lie down. Because if I sit up or I'm upright, the headache gets worse and worse and worse. Eating should be a modality, right? I think lycopodium is the main remedy under head pain from fasting if hunger isn't appeased immediately. That's one of, I think, five or six remedies in that rubric. So that's something else we look for. Anything that makes your symptoms better or makes your symptoms worse.
We have a lot of our clients who have sinus issues or headaches that come on with the change of weather. If there are certain weather patterns that can really bring on their symptoms as well, headaches or sinus pain or whatever else.
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. And then the other thing I wanted to kind of touch on, so there's sensation, what does it feel like? Sensation is helpful, but it has to be kind of unique. That's what I found over the years. Location is also can be quite helpful, especially if it's unique. There's some remedies like the remedy Murex. It has location as far as ailments. The ailments go crosswise. So that, as an example, if the patient says, it's right around my right ovary, and then the pain shoots and extends over towards my left chest. That's a very unique location or symptom for the remedy Murex. So sensation, location, modalities, what makes symptoms better or makes them worse, the exciting cause, put them into that remedy state in the first place. And then the last thing, which can be very helpful, are concomitant symptoms. And a concomitant symptom are things that happen with or things that happen beforehand. So years ago, I had a patient, I was going back and forth between two or three remedies. And she said, when I was nursing my child, every time I nursed my child, I would get pain in my teeth. So you can go under teeth pain while nursing the child. And there's one remedy in there. It's China. And then you think about it. And China has ailments from loss of fluid. So while the mother's feeding, she's giving out breast milk, which is a bodily fluid. And so that's why that makes sense that it was there. So concomitant symptoms can be, you know, if they have a headache and then during their headache, their eyes start to just water, right? Lacrimation during head pain. Or it can be, you know, preceding it. And that mirror is very well known for getting numbness around the lips or the face before their migraines, or it can be during the migraines. Any visual disturbances. One that I find quite useful in acutes, especially if there's fevers, are when the fever happens, if there's coryza or, you know, clear runny discharge from the nose with the fever. Mm-hmm. You know, I think what's the remedy is, I think tuberculinum has aching in the thighs during fever. Wow. So anything that happens during another symptom. So the two symptoms are related, mm-hmm. whether this happens first and then the next symptom happens directly after it, mm-hmm. or they happen at the same time. Mm-hmm. Those are extremely useful in practice.
So, there's a really good one that your buddy Luke actually had a while ago. I think it was the start of this year. He said pain in the distal parts when coughing. So he was coughing, but he had pain in different parts of the body. And that's, I think it was capsicum, which was quite an interesting remedy. And I heard one of the best symptoms. I mean, people never cease to amaze me, but I had such a goodie this week. A client said she gets burning pain on the tip of her nose with her period. And there was one remedy in there, Carbo Animalis.
Carbo Animalis, yep.
Yeah. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah. Well, I actually did a presentation and I forget what it was on, but I went over Carbo Animalis and that remedy has a very, has an affinity for the tip of the nose. Mm-hmm. So whether whether it's an icy coldness or a burning or pimples, any type of eruption on the tip of the nose, Carbo Animalis is one of the remedies to consider.
I did not know that.
Yeah. That's something else to consider when you're studying homeopathy, is to look at which tissues does this remedy have an affinity for, right? And it's very well laid out in like in Boger's Synoptic Key. When he talks about a remedy, you know, he does the modalities and then he talks about the affinities these remedies have an affinity for nerve tissue, or these remedies have an affinity for dermal tissue. These remedies have an affinity for mucosa. So that's also another good way to get the whole picture when you're case taking.
That's very exciting. Do you know what, Matt? As we were chatting, I suddenly had a thought. How about we play a little game and we do a mock case? So I'll be your client with a headache. And you can maybe just ask me the types of questions that you would ask a client if they were coming in with a headache, and I'll just make up some answers just to give our listeners a bit of an idea of what it might sound like if you're having a consultation.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. No problem. So if I know that you're coming in for a headache, the first thing I would say is I would do an open-ended question. So I'd say, tell me a little bit about your headache.
Okay. So it started about a month ago. I'm going to be a closed client, so I'm not going to give you lots of information. You're going to have to work for it.
Okay.
Yeah, it started about a month ago.
Okay. So then what I'd want to know is, if it started a month ago, was anything going on around that time or just prior to that time? Anything that was stressful to you or anything that had, you know, was bothering you at the time?
Mm-hmm. I had an argument with a colleague around that time.
Oh, okay. So would you be okay with talking about that a bit?
Yeah, sure.
Really helped me. It would help me to be able to help you to really understand what was your experience with this argument and that colleague. So if you could talk to me about that, then that would really help me.
Yeah, sure. We just had a disagreement on how something should be done. And I felt really sad. I wanted to have a cry, but I couldn't. And it was just a very confronting experience. And I don't like confrontation.
I see. So can you tell me a little bit about your experience with arguments and confrontation, and when you get upset to that point, do you have a pattern like that in life? You know, is that typical for you, or is that very atypical? What happened a month ago?
It's very typical. I really don't like confrontation, so when that happens, then I tend to shy away from it.
Okay. So the other question I would have for you, well, there's a couple more, but so when you get to that point emotionally where you get that upset, Do you get any physiologic reactions? Is a headache typical for you? Or do you get any GI issues? Or mm-hmm. does anything else happen when you get emotionally worked up?
Mm-hmm. My bowels can get a bit loose. So I would find I have to go to the toilet more often when that happens.
Okay. So, all right. So the headache's been going on for about a month and you got into this argument or disagreement. So then tell me about the headache a little bit. You know, what's the location of the headache?
So the headache is on the left-hand side around my temple, and it just feels like it's behind my left eyeball as well, just in that area.
Okay. Okay. And what's the exact quality of the sensation of the pain that you have?
It feels like somebody is stabbing me with a knife on that side of my head.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So when you have these, is there anything that makes the headache worse? Things that you avoid because you know that if you continue to do something or you expose to any particular thing, that it actually makes the headache worse.
I'm definitely sensitive to sounds when that happens, and I don't like bright lights. And if I can lie down in a dark room, it definitely helps.
Okay. So I'm just going to break for a second here. This is really good. And one of the things that I do as a practitioner that I've learned over the years is when somebody says something makes something worse, I want to get a sense of it, you know. So they say I have a headache and it sticks, and then when I'm exposed to light, it goes to a 10, or I'm exposed to noise and it goes to a 7, I'm going to take the light modality because it has a stronger effect on the person's symptoms. And then the same thing with the modalities that make things better. Mm-hmm. You know, you said I definitely have to lay down. So there is a rubric where they're under head pain where they must lie down. Mm-hmm. So if the headache compels, that they cannot, when they have a headache, they cannot sit up and they cannot walk around. They have to lie down. Then I use the rubric must lie down. Mm-hmm. And then I try to find out, okay, if the pain is at an 8 and you do something that alleviates the pain, let's say an ice pack or, you know, lying down, I want to know where does it take the 8? Does it take it down to a 2, which is something I would definitely use. If it takes it from an 8 to a 6, then I probably won't use it unless I have nothing else. Mm-hmm. Because we're looking for the strongest modalities. Mm-hmm.
If I have a really good cry and I eat cucumber, then I feel much better.
Okay. Okay. So then we would continue on from there. And I would try to find out, are there any concomitant symptoms? Like when you have the headache, does anything else happen? So we're looking for concomitants, like
there can be some vomiting with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, some vomiting, and yeah, my feet get really hot. I'm literally snagging stuff up as I'm going here. This is none of my actual symptoms at all. But yeah, I'm just trying to think of some of the things clients have said to me. But yeah, my feet get really hot, and I can sometimes have a vomit with this headache on the left-hand side.
Okay.
It pushes against my eyeball.
Sure, sure. So the vomiting, nausea and vomiting is quite common. We can use those to get into the ballpark of the right remedy. But I would say that the hot feet would be much more unique. So this is a good time to talk about when you're case taking. The homeopath is really trying to figure out which symptoms are kind of common and which symptoms are common to the disease, and then which symptoms are unique. What we call the SRP, what's strange, rare, and peculiar. And so if somebody were to tell me, when I get a headache, my feet get really hot, I would try to find that in the repertory because that's unique. When I hear something I haven't heard in 20 years, then I go to the repertory and I go, the remedy has to be in that rubric. And the rubric is a symptom that's been noted over the last 200 years. It's in our repertory. And it'll be a symptom, and then it's associated with remedies that have cured that symptom in a clinical setting. Mm-hmm. So a rubric can have one remedy in it, or it can have 700. And once you get up to 700 remedies, the rubric becomes almost useless because there's too many remedies. It's not specific enough.
Excellent. Well, that was fun. Sorry to put you on the spot there. I just thought it might be interesting for our listeners to get a bit of an idea of what sort of information we find helpful. And I'm wondering, Matt, once you've given a what we call a similimum or a constitutional remedy, or basically a remedy that most closely matches the client's case, what sort of things do you hear clients say when they've had that remedy that most closely matches their case? Because people will often ask me, what can I expect? And obviously it depends on the case. But what are some things that you often hear people say after they've had a constitutional remedy?
Right. I get that as well. What can I expect? Which can also be an indication of the remedy, right? Mm-hmm, some remedies, they are very uncomfortable with the unknown. So it's very difficult to predict exactly what the reaction can be of the vital force to the remedy. If we're going to assume that we gave this similimum, because let's say regardless of how hard we strive to find the right remedy and how much you want to get the right remedy with every single case, we don't give the right remedy the first time every time. But let's say in the case where we've given the right remedy, you can have the reactions you can get are almost instantaneously the symptoms can start to ameliorate and get better and resolve. That's one response. Another response is you give the right remedy and you get an aggravation. So the symptoms can get mildly worse and then they'll start to get better. You can have a reaction where nothing seems to happen. And how long you wait is dependent on whether this is an acute case or this is a chronic case, right? How urgent are these symptoms? You know, if you're dealing with somebody that may need to go to the hospital and, you know, you don't wait very long. So with the similone, those are the two most common reactions. Either they start to get amelioration right away. Sometimes people say that they get really sleepy. They went to sleep when they woke up, their symptoms were 40% better and 80% better, something like that. Aggravations typically should not be as intense as the symptoms of the disease itself, mm-hmm. right? So somebody, let's stick with headaches because that's what we've been talking about. If somebody typically their head pain goes to an 8, and let's say you're treating them for a chronic headache and you give them a remedy and they have an aggravation, they should feel like a headache might start to come on. So it should go maybe to like a 2 or a 3, but it should not go up to an 8. If it goes up to an 8, that's probably not an aggravation. So those are the two typical things. Usually you can have aggravation beforehand and then you'll get amelioration, or you can get amelioration either almost instantaneously, or sometimes it takes a half a day or so in an acute case, you know, any 10, 12 hours for things to start getting better. The thing that's really important that I want to say about this is that once you've taken a dose and you start to get a response of the vital force, whether it's a response leaning towards an aggravation or you're starting to just get amelioration, it's really always best to wait to see how much more improvement you get before you redose. You don't want to do a protocol approach where you're giving the remedy every 2 hours for the next 3 or 4 days, especially if it's a potency that's higher than a 12C. Mm-hmm. Right? In my experience, 30C is high enough for most acutes. And so that's really, it's something I think that we really struggle with as practitioners. It takes us years to finally get it. When you start to see improvement in the vital force, it's like a dropping a pebble or a stone into water and watching the wave of mm-hmm. the pebble that hit the water ripples. Work its way out. Yeah, the ripples. And you're waiting for the ripples to finish working their way out. So you don't want to change the remedy too soon. You don't want to take another remedy or take remedies in combination with each other. And you don't want to redose too frequently, because redosing too frequently will cause an aggravation and it will cause the resolution that you're looking for. It prolongs it. It makes it take longer. So that's a really, really important point.
And I'm wondering as well, if you're able to share some cases from your clinic with us.
Sure, absolutely. It was actually last Friday, I had a longstanding patient contact me because her partner was a 75-year-old male. For the previous 2 days, so like last Wednesday, Thursday, and they contacted me Friday. Severe, severe left-sided kidney pain. He went into emergent care, and the patient sent me a message after the fact that the doctor said for his age and for the size of his kidney stone, which they had diagnosed him with, that he wasn't going to be able to pass the stone, and he's going to need surgery. Mm-hmm. So they contacted me on Friday. I took his case. He was somebody that just doesn't give symptoms. He had already taken a Percocet, so he's kind of out of it a little bit. So I did the best I could, and I got location. It was in the left ureter. There weren't a whole lot of symptoms. I used mostly just the fact that I knew that lycopodium is a main remedy for kidney stones. Mm-hmm. It's typically right-sided. This happened to be left-sided, but lycopodium was a grade 2 under left-sided kidney stones and problems or complaints with the left ureter. There were one or two other things that I saw in his case. So I told them to take, and to be honest, I didn't have enough information to make a strong case for lycopodium. Mm-hmm. The other remedy I was looking at was belladonna, because Kent says, and I've used this 2 or 3 times in the past, Kent says low dose belladonna, so a 3C or 2C or a 6C, if it's given, it can relax circular smooth muscle, right? And we see that in the eyes, right? If you take belladonna or in belladonna poisonings, or if we're looking to get one, what are the indications for belladonna? Are dilated pupils. Yeah. So that's circular smooth muscle. So when we look at tubes in the body, you know, we look at the ureters, we look at the gall duct, you look at the urethra, you can look at peristalsis, there's circular smooth muscle there. So Kent says that if you don't have any symptoms, you can give belladonna on a very low potency, and it will help that circular smooth muscle stop spasming. So it'll help to pass gallstones and kidney stones. So we went with lycopodium first, and he was getting much better. And they gave him a dose that was inappropriate to give, because again, our time zones were 11 hours apart. So I think while I was sleeping, they gave another dose, and he started to get worse. Mm-hmm. And he had to take another Percocet, but he had improved so much. So I had told them to take a dose or two of the belladonna because they had it in a 6C, and they did that. And then we went back to the lycopodium. So let's see, I started on Friday. By Sunday, he was up doing chores, no pain, and essentially he averted the surgery.
Amazing.
And those pathological cases are very satisfying, because people aren't supposed to respond this way in the allopathic world, right? That was supposed to be a surgical case. Mm-hmm. You know, gallstones are supposed to be surgical cases. Hernias are supposed to be surgical cases. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this past spring, I had a patient who had a umbilical hernia since her 3-year-old son was born. And I gave her an indicated remedy, and within a week, her umbilical hernia went away.
Wow. And
I know. I was completely amazed. So homeopathy has the power to do really amazing things. But like I said earlier, there has to be a level of surrender and just a level of being open to the infinite. Like, you know, anything is possible, especially with homeopathy, anything is possible. It's a really, really miraculous medicine. Those are just one case that came to mind as you asked.
Our bodies have such an incredible capacity to heal itself. Our bodies want to heal itself. And if we can stay away from suppressing symptoms and instead give it something like homeopathy, which can really stimulate our vital force to heal itself, it is the most beautiful, beautiful thing to see. I just had a case of impetigo this week, and the mum sent me a photo of the little girl with sores all over her face, legs, arms. Uh-huh. And she said, "My husband is really pressuring me to use antibiotics right now." And I said to her, "It's your child. It's your choice. If you want to do the antibiotics, that's fine. But we can try some homeopathics in the meantime." And we gave some ant crude, and we gave her the staph strep nozode, and I think some calendula, and we used hypercal mother tincture topically. And 3 days later, she sent me more photos. And, you know, a picture paints a thousand words, and pictures don't lie. Mm-hmm. And you can see the photo from the one day to 3 days later, and it's starting to scab over. The redness is gone. It's looking so much better. And you could just hear in her voice how much calmer she is. And she was like, "Wow, my husband is now a believer as well. We can't believe it." And, you know, just look at these photos. It's just a simple case. You know, it's just impetigo, school sores, you know, nothing major, but our bodies are just so incredible to heal itself.
Yeah, that's what Hahnemann said. It's like the vital force is looking for help through signs and symptoms. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to put yourself in the mindset that you're being attacked by something. You know, if somebody is in that mindset, then they might need an animal remedy. You know, that could be an indication that I'm being attacked or I'm being invaded or this or that. But the reality is the symptoms are just signposts to get somebody that's versed in homeopathy to the right remedy, and then you give the remedy and the vital force responds, and then the disease goes away. You know, in most cases. And it doesn't matter whether it's a couple months ago, I was contacted by somebody, young man in his 20s, and he had had a psychotic break about 10 years before, and he was up all night with lights on and thinking that there were spirits trying to come in and take his soul. And, you know, I took his case very carefully, and I put him on a 6C once a day, and he was back to his normal self. He almost immediately started getting back to his normal self, but his parents were still so worried because they had been through 10 years before that they did take him to the hospital just out of an abundance of caution, but he really didn't need it. Mm-hmm. And he made a complete recovery with stramonium, you know?
Oh, I love stramonium. I have honestly lost count of how many children I've helped with this remedy with night terrors. Mm-hmm. It's such a great remedy. Hey, and when your child has something like night terrors, I mean, what do? Do you take him to a psychologist? Do you put him on drugs? Like, what do?
Right.
Like, all these kiddies who see monsters and spirits and things in their room who are unable to sleep, who are just so affected by these energies, you give them stramonium. And I don't know, it's like it magically changes their energy, and suddenly these things that affected them previously are not affecting them anymore. It's just beautiful.
Yeah. You know, another remedy that you should really consider when you're looking at stramonium, like if you're thinking or that the symptoms are taking you to stramonium for night terrors, is calibromatum. Calibromatum I have done studies on these remedies, and I've obviously used them over the years. And I had a woman, I was seeing her for something else. I've seen both her and her husband. And for the first 6 months, I was treating for these things. And then 6 months in, she says, well, for the last 30 years, I've had these horrible nightmares. And they wake me up, and the husband's like, yeah, every night she wakes up screaming. Mm. And they didn't tell me this for the first 6 months of treatment. And so I ended up, you know, taking her case. And she was like, it's just like, it's like the end of the universe. I wake up and I'm just so... I can't see, so foreboding. I ended up giving calibromatum. Her night terrors that she'd had for 20 years went away.
Amazing. Calibromatum has the delusion she saw her brother fall overboard in her sight. Is that the one?
That's the one that has that. Yeah. The main thing for calibromatum, it's a delusion that they've been selected for divine vengeance. Mm-hmm. And essentially that God is after them. Mm-hmm. That delusion that you mentioned about seeing their brother fall overboard, it's a feeling of guilt. I wasn't able to help them. You know, that's the kind of the underlying feeling for that. So guilt is a big aspect of the calibromatum. But acutely, you know, you can, and that's the amazing thing about homeopathy, like you can learn about the personality type, but then you can also go into the old repertory and the rubrics and the materia medica, and you can see why else it was given if you don't have a sense of the personality type, or you know, the remedy that fits the personality. You've given those remedies and you're not getting the results you want, you can go in and look at the patient's case from a different angle as well.
Yeah, that's a beautiful one. Amy Lansky mentioned calibromatum in her book Impossible Cure, because her younger son had autism and he was cured with homeopathy, but the older son ended up developing some symptoms. I can't remember exactly what it was, but they ended up giving him calibromatum because, you know, the delusion of seeing the brother or this whoever falling overboard in their sight, and there was that guilt and that feeling of you know, having to look after his brother and not being able to look after his brother, and guilt around that. And he's responded really well to that remedy.
Nice. Very good. Very good.
It kind of ties into my last question that I always ask my guests, and that is, what are your top three remedies that you could not live without, and why?
Oh, top three remedies. I would say number one is Nature Myriaticum. That remedy's helped me quite a bit over the years, and I kind of feel like people that need it end up finding me some way. I mean, I think I give more Nature Myriaticum with really good success than any other remedy. Mm-hmm. I would say that one, Lycopodium, has come up quite a bit over the years, and Sepia as well. Yeah. And I think I'm selecting those three just on how valuable they've been over the years, like what I've seen them do. So, but it's always important to, obviously, I'm always open to the small remedies, you know, like when do I give Lemna Minor? When do I give, you know, all these other little remedies? Because we've got, you know, depending on who you ask, 1,200 to
8,000.
8,000 remedies.
Yeah.
But the newer remedies, I tend to wait on a bit to see how they're going to play out. I like to wait to kind of see, because you don't want to get into this realm of speculation. And it's very easy to get into theory and speculation in homeopathy. And so it's good to stay anchored in symptoms and materia medica that are tried and true. So if you stick with the case taking the materia medica that has been used for 200 years, it's been, you know, I mean, the level of homeopathy that we had 120 to 150 years ago, I think was far superior as far as clinical training. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in 1900, when you wanted to practice homeopathy or wanted to learn about it, your teachers, you'd go to a medical school And you would be there, you would learn anatomy, you'd learn physiology. It was like a medical training, but you learned homeopathy. And then all of your teachers had 20, 30, 40 years of experience, most of them. And they treated things like, you know, the plague and tuberculosis and, you know, like John Clark's war remedy, where he talks about gunpowder, the homeopathic remedy. So you had these clinicians that had decades of experience treating extremely severe pathology. And those were your teachers. They, you know, and that lineage was broken. I don't want to get too much into the history of it, but that lineage was broken. So, you know, the homeopaths we have now, we're good, but we didn't have the same level of experience. And the teachers that taught us didn't have the same level of experience that they did 120 years ago. That's my only point about that. So, but everything happens for a reason. And there's a reason that we are where we are with regard to homeopathy today. And it's going to go on. Homeopathy is not going anywhere because Hahnemann didn't create the principles that govern homeopathy. He elucidated them. So he brought them to life. They're always there. They're like the laws of chemistry and the laws of physics. They're not going anywhere. And as long as there's a universe, there's going to be homeopathy.
I love that. That is absolutely beautiful. What a great way for us to finish off. As long as there's a universe, there's homeopathy.
Exactly.
I'm going to get that printed on a t-shirt and I'll have to post you a copy.
Please do. I appreciate that.
Have you trademarked that yet? You should.
I have. That just came to me. Spontaneous.
You know, it's interesting as well because the homeopaths in those days didn't have the monster of a pharmaceutical industry to deal with that we do these days. So they were allowed to treat all sorts of things, which these days, you know, for various reasons, we're not allowed to supposedly treat or help with. So
they made headlines. You know, I mean, they were written up in the papers in New York went through the different, you know, plagues and epidemics that went through the poorer sections of the city. I don't know if you know The Logic of Numbers and Statistics. I think it is by Bradshaw. I'll have to get the book to you later. But they compare at the time allopathic versus homeopathic treatment. And homeopathic treatment, whether it was in a prison or a hospital, or, you know, it didn't matter where it was or what they were treating, homeopathy outperformed every single time. Mm-hmm. And even now, I don't know if do you know who the Pulfords are? They were a father and a son, and they were in the U.S. And well, there was a historian that compiled all of their cases, and they had over 3,000 cases of pneumonia that they treated between the two of them and their practice. And they think their practice spanned over 60, 80 years, something like that. So the historian compiled the mortality rate for all of these over 3,000 cases of pneumonia that they had treated. The mortality rate turned out to be 0.17%.
Wow.
And even today with antibiotics, the mortality rate's about 5%. And most of that's in elderly people, you know, as soon as you get over 65 and you have comorbidities. But still people succumb to bacterial pneumonia and viral pneumonia all the time. But the, you know, homeopathy is absolutely amazing with regard to treating these diseases. Mm-hmm. It's a blessing for us.
Yeah, I can tell that we're going to need a part 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of this podcast. Sure. So please rebook for the next one because there's so much more to chat about. This is just like skimming the surface. But I'm wondering, before we finish off, Matt, are you able to tell our listeners where they can get hold of you? And I'll pop it in the show notes, but just so you can tell people who may be driving and can't look at the show notes right now, where can they get hold of you?
Yeah. So if people want to get in touch with me, they can go to my website, which is www.vitalforcemedicine. It's all lowercase. So vitalforcemedicine.com. That's one way. They can email me. My email are my initials, M as in Matthew, Z as in Zebra, N as in Nancy, D as in Doctor, 72@gmail.com. Or they can find me on Facebook as well. I'm there, Matt Zorn, Facebook, Vital Force Medicine on Facebook as well. So those are some places they can find me.
Excellent. And you do consultations online for anyone in the world?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of part of our move into the fourth industrial revolution. The World Wide Web is becoming the place to do work. But on the one hand, I couldn't be where I am right now in the world and help as many people as I can help. So on that end, it's a positive.
Mm-hmm, I agree. Thank you so much for your time, Matthew. I can't wait for the next installment. I'll chat with you soon.
All right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the invite and the ability to be able to talk with you and reach your listeners. I'm grateful. So thank you.
Thank you. Hi, homies. I hope you've enjoyed the episode. Let's continue the conversation in the Homeopathy Hangout podcast Facebook group, where you'll get to hang out with myself and many of the past guests from the show. The only way I can continue this podcast is with your support. Please consider making a donation at buymeacoffee.com/hangout, where you can make a once-off $5 donation or become a monthly patron at www.patreon.com/homeopathy hangout. You can also leave a 5-star review on whichever podcast app you use to listen to this show, or leave a Google business review, or check out my Rumble or YouTube channels and be sure to subscribe there, or follow me on Instagram and Facebook, or simply share this podcast with your family and friends. Whichever way you decide to support the show, I want you to know that I deeply appreciate it and I look forward to continuing to serve you the best I possibly can. You're also welcome to check out my website, www.eugeniekruger.com, where you can purchase our range of stunning homeopathic kits, single remedies and combination remedies, or you can book a consult with any of the homeopaths on my team, and you can sign up for my newsletter as well. Lastly, if you're interested in advertising on my show, please email info@eugeniekruger.com. Thanks so much, and I look forward to catching you at the next episode.